This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Tonight I'm going to air a program that first aired in 2011, and it features T.S. Eliot and then our annual tradition of Dylan Thomas reading A Child's Christmas in Wales. But before we begin that, here is a salute to the great Nelson Mandela. This is Bring Back Nelson Mandela from the musical Serafina. This is Catherine Hastings, and you are listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Tonight's program features an odd pairing for sure, T.S. Eliot and Dylan Thomas. The two men were contemporaries, along with W.H. Auden, but had little else in common. Eliot's poem, The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock, which you'll hear him read later in the show, has been regarded as a masterpiece of the modernist movement. Dylan Thomas has more in common with the Romantic tradition. So why put them on the same show? Well, for two very simple reasons. First, it's been a long time since I've looked at Eliot myself, and I wanted to revisit both his life and work. And as for Thomas, it won't be his poetry we hear tonight, but his beloved short story, A Child's Christmas in Wales. I'll begin with Eliot and end with Thomas reading his story. I suspect that most people who listen to this show know plenty already about Eliot, but here are just a few highlights about the poet's life to refresh your memories. He was born Thomas Stearns Eliot on September 26, 1888, and died on January 4, 1965. He was a literary critic, playwright, and perhaps one of the most important English language poets of the 20th century. Born in America, he became a naturalized British subject at the age of 39. A couple of things were prominent in feeding Eliot's passion with literature when he was a child. First, he had a health issue, a double hernia, that prevented him from participating in all physical and many social activities. Robert Sancourt, a close friend of Eliot's, wrote that he would often curl up in the window seat behind an enormous book, setting the drug of dreams against the pain of living. In addition, Eliot credited his hometown with providing inspiration. "It is self-evident," he wrote, "that St. Louis affected me more deeply than any other environment has ever done. I feel that there is something in having passed one's childhood beside the big river, which is incommunicable to those people who have not." Eliot began to write poetry when he was 14 and published his first poem in 1905. Later, from 1906 to 09, he studied philosophy at Harvard and during this time forged a lifelong friendship with the novelist Conrad Aiken. After working there until 1910, he studied at the Sorbonne in Paris and then returned to Harvard and finally to Merton College, Oxford, where he had won a scholarship. On New Year's Eve, 1914, he wrote to Aiken, "I hate university towns and university people who are the same everywhere, with pregnant wives, sprawling children, many books, and hideous pictures on the walls. Oxford is very pretty, but I don't like to be dead." He spent a good deal of time in London to get away from that feeling of being dead, and it was here, through Conrad Aiken, that he first met Ezra Pound. Pound promoted Eliot everywhere, including literary circles and social events. After a year, Eliot left Merton. Just touching on a few more things before we hear him read, he was unhappily married to Vivian Haywood, and she was unhappily married to him. Pound helped them both believe that she would save Eliot the poet by keeping him in England. "To me," Pound wrote, "the marriage brought the state of mind out of which came the Wasteland." That says it all. The Wasteland is, of course, the famous poem seen as a poetic counterpart to James Joyce's Ulysses, which was published the same year. It was heavily edited by Ezra Pound. The couple did end up divorcing, and Eliot married a second time at the age of 68 to Esme Valerie Fletcher, who was just 32. Of his poetry and nationality, Eliot said, "My poetry has obviously more in common with my distinguished contemporaries in America than with anything written in my generation in England. It wouldn't be what it is, and I imagine it wouldn't be so good, if I'd been born in England, and it wouldn't be what it is if I'd stayed in America. It's a combination of things, but in its sources, in its emotional springs, it comes from America." Besides The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock and The Wasteland, Eliot is best known for The Hollow Men, and I do remember being blown away in high school by the lines, "This is the way the world ends, not with a bang, but a whimper." And Ash Wednesday, sometimes referred to as his conversion poem with its basis of Orthodox Christianity.
Elliott himself regarded four quartets as his masterpiece, and it is for this work that he was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature. It contains four long poems, Burnt Norton, East Coker, The Dray Salvages, and Little Gidding. Each poem is associated with one of the four classical elements, air, earth, water, and fire. Well, it would take a full hour more to even begin to address Eliot's life and accomplishments. Clearly, we don't have time. But before playing Eliot reading The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock and East Coker from Four Quartets, and perhaps one other if there's time, there is one more issue about the man that can't go unsaid, and that is the accusation leveled against him that he was anti-Semitic. Several examples have been presented, most notably by Anthony Julius in T.S. Eliot, Anti-Semitism in Literary Form, published in 1966. One example appears in Eliot's poem, Burbank with a Baedeker, Bleistein with a Cigar. The rats are underneath the piles. The Jew is underneath the lot. Money in furs. Julius interprets the lines as an indirect comparison of Jews to rats. But perhaps the most obvious example of Eliot's anti-Semitism was delivered in a lecture series called After Strange Gods, A Primer of Modern Heresy, given at the University of Virginia in 1933. Quote, "What is still more important than cultural homogeneity," Eliot stated, "is unity of religious background, and reasons of race and religion combine to make any large number of free-thinking Jews undesirable." Horrific. There are those who tried to defend Eliot from the charge of anti-Semitism. Craig Raine wrote a whole book on the subject. When Paul Dean reviewed that book, in defense of T.S. Eliot, he wasn't convinced, but concluded, quote, "Ultimately, as both Raine and, to do him justice, Julius insist, however much Eliot may have been compromised as a person, as we all are in our several ways, his greatness as a poet remains." Eliot, a heavy smoker, died of emphysema in London on January 4, 1965. In accordance with his wishes, his ashes were taken to St. Michael's Church in East Coker, the village from which his ancestors had emigrated to America. Here now is T.S. Eliot reading The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock and East Coker.
Let us go then, you and I, when the evening is spread out against the sky like a patient etherized upon a table. Let us go through certain half-deserted streets, the muttering retreats of restless nights in one-night cheap hotels and sawdust restaurants with oyster shells. Streets that follow like a tedious argument of insidious intent to lead you to an overwhelming question. Oh, do not ask, what is it? Let us go and make our visit. In the room, the women come and go, talking of Michelangelo. The yellow fog that rubs its back upon the window panes, the yellow smoke that rubs its muzzle on the window panes, licked its tongue into the corners of the evening, lingered upon the pools that stand in drains, let fall upon its back the soot that falls from chimneys, slipped by the terrace, made a sudden leap, and seeing that it was a soft October night, curled once about the house and fell asleep. And indeed, there will be time for the yellow smoke that slides along the street, rubbing its back upon the window panes. There will be time to prepare a face to meet the faces that you meet. There will be time to murder and create, and time for all the works and days of hands that lift and drop a question on your plate. Time for you and time for me, and time yet for 100 indecisions and for 100 visions and revisions before the taking of a toast and tea. In the room, the women come and go, talking of Michelangelo. and indeed there will be time to wonder, do I dare, and do I dare? Time to turn back and descend the stair with a bald spot in the middle of my hair. They will say how his hair is growing thin. My morning coat, my collar mounting firmly to the chin. My necktie rich and modest, but asserted by a simple pin. They will say, but how his arms and legs are thin. Do I dare disturb the universe? In a minute there is time for decisions and revisions, which a minute will reverse. For I have known them all already, known them all, have known the evenings, mornings, afternoons. I have measured out my life with coffee spoons. I know the voices dying with a dying fall beneath the music from a farther room. So how should I presume? And I have known the eyes already, known them all, the eyes that fix you in a formulated phrase, and when I am formulated sprawling on a pin, when I am pinned and wriggling on the wall, then how should I begin to spit out all the butt ends of my days and ways, and how should I presume? And I have known the arms already, known them all, arms that are braceleted and white and bare, but in the lamplight, down with light brown hair. Is it perfume from a dress that makes me so digress? Arms that lie along a table or wrap about a shawl? And should I then presume? And how should I begin? Shall I say? I have gone at dusk through narrow streets and watched the smoke that rises from the pipes of lonely men in shirt sleeves leaning out of windows. I should have been a pair of ragged claws scuttling across the floors of silent seas. And the afternoon, the evening, sleeps so peacefully, smoothed by long fingers, asleep, tired, or it malingers, stretched on the floor here beside you and me. Should I, after tea and cakes and ices, have the strength to force the moment to its crisis? But though I have wept and fasted, wept and prayed, though I have seen my head grown slightly bald, brought in upon a platter, I am no prophet, and here's no great matter. I have seen the moment of my greatness flicker, and I have seen the eternal footman hold my coat and snicker, and in short, I was afraid. And would it have been worth it, after all, after the cups, the marmalade, the tea, among the porcelain, among some talk of you and me, would it have been worthwhile to have bitten off the matter with a smile, to have squeezed the universe into a ball, to roll it toward some overwhelming question, to say, I am Lazarus, come from the dead, come back to tell you all, I shall tell you all, if one, settling a pillow by her head, should say, that is not what I meant at all. That is not it at all. And would it have been worth it after all? Would it have been worthwhile after the sunsets and the dooryards and the sprinkled streets, after the novels, after the teacups, after the skirts that trail along the floor, and this and so much more? It is impossible to say just what I mean. But as if a magic lantern threw the nerves in patterns on a screen, would it have been worthwhile if one, settling a pillow or throwing off a shawl and turning toward the window, should say, that is not it at all. That is not what I meant at all. No, I am not Prince Hamlet, nor was meant to be. I am an attendant lord, one that will do to swell a progress, start a scene or two. Advise the prince, no doubt, an easy tool. Deferential, glad to be of use, politic, cautious, and meticulous. Full of high sentence, but a bit obtuse. At times, indeed, almost ridiculous. Almost, at times, the fool. I grow old. I shall wear the bottoms of my trousers rolled. Shall I part my hair behind? Do I dare to eat a peach? I shall wear white flannel trousers and walk upon the beach. I have heard the mermaids singing, each to each. I do not think that they will sing to me. I have seen them riding seaward on the waves, combing the white hair of the waves blown back when the wind blows the water white and black. We have lingered in the chambers of the sea by seagulls wreathed with seaweed, red and brown, till human voices wake us and we drown.
That was T.S. Eliot reading The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock, and here he is reading East Coker from Four Quartets.
East Coker. In my beginning is my end. In succession, houses rise and fall, crumble, are extended, are removed, destroyed, restored, or in their place is an open field or a factory or a bypass. Old stone to new building, old timber to new fires, old fires to ashes and ashes to the earth, which is already flesh, fur and feces, bone of man and beast, cornstalk and leaf. Houses live and die, there is a time for building and a time for living and for generation. And a time for the wind to break the loosened pane and to shake the wainscot where the field mouse trots and to shake the tattered arras woven with a silent motto. In my beginning is my end. Now the light falls across the open field, leaving the deep lane shuttered with branches, dark in the afternoon, where you lean against a bank while a van passes. And the deep lane insists on the direction into the village. In the electric heat, hypnotized. In a warm haze, the sultry light is absorbed, not refracted, by gray stone. The dahlias sleep in the empty silence. Wait for the early owl. In that open field, if you do not come too close, if you do not come too close, on a summer midnight, you can hear the music of the weak pipe and the little drum, and see them dancing around the bonfire, the association of man and woman, in dancing signifying matrimony, a dignified and commodious sacrament. Two and two, necessary conjunction, holding each other by the hand or the arm which betokeneth concord. Round and round the fire, leaping through the flames or joined in circles, rustically solemn or in rustic laughter, lifting heavy feet in clumsy shoes, earth feet, loam feet, lifted in country mirth, mirth of those long since under earth, nourishing the corn, keeping time, keeping the rhythm in their dancing, as in their living, in the living seasons, the time of the seasons and the constellations, the time of milking and the time of harvest, the time of the coupling of man and woman and that of beasts, feet rising and falling, eating and drinking, dung and death. Dawn points, and another day prepares for heat and silence. Out at sea, the dawn wind wrinkles and slides. I am here or there or elsewhere in my beginning. What is the late November doing with the disturbance of the spring and creatures of the summer heat and snowdrops writhing under feet and hollyhocks that aim too high, red into gray and tumble down, late roses filled with early snow? Thunder rolled by the rolling stars simulates triumphal cars deployed in constellated wars. Scorpion fights against the sun until the sun and moon go down. Comets weep and Leonids fly, hunt the heavens and the plains, whirled in a vortex that shall bring the world to that destructive fire which burns before the ice cap rains. That was a way of putting it. Not very satisfactory. A periphrastic study in a worn-out poetical fashion. leaving one still with the intolerable wrestle with words and meanings, the poetry does not matter. It was not to start again what one had expected. What was to be the value of the long looked forward to, long hoped for calm, the autumnal serenity and the wisdom of age? Had they deceived us, or deceived themselves, the quiet-voiced elders, bequeathing us merely a receipt for deceit? The serenity only a deliberate habitude, the wisdom only the knowledge of dead secrets, useless in the darkness into which they peered or from which they turned their eyes. There is, it seems to us, at best, only a limited value in the knowledge derived from experience. The knowledge imposes a pattern and falsifies, for the pattern is new in every moment, and every moment is a new and shocking valuation of all we have been. We are only undeceived of that which, deceiving, could no longer harm. In the middle, not only in the middle of the way, but all the way, in a dark wood, in a bramble, on the edge of a grimpin where is no secure foothold, and menaced by monsters, fancy lights, risking enchantment. Do not let me hear of the wisdom of old men, but rather of their folly, their fear of fear and frenzy, their fear of possession, of belonging to another or to others or to God. The only wisdom we can hope to acquire is the wisdom of humility. Humility is endless. The houses are all gone under the sea. The dancers are all gone under the hill. Oh, dark, 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 they all go into the dark, the vacant interstellar spaces, the vacant into the vacant, the captains, merchant bankers, eminent men of letters, the generous patrons of art, the statesmen and the rulers, distinguished civil servants, chairmen of many committees, industrial lords and petty contractors all go into the dark, and dark the sun and moon and the almanac de Gotha and the stock exchange gazette, the directory of directors, and cold the sense and lost the motive of action. And we all go with them into the silent funeral, nobody's funeral, for there is no one to bury. I said to my soul, be still, and let the dark come upon you, which shall be the darkness of God. As in a theater, the lights are extinguished for the scene to be changed with a hollow rumble of wings, with a movement of darkness on darkness, and we know that the hills and the trees, the distant panorama, and the bold, imposing facade are all being rolled away. Or as when an underground train in the tube stops too long between stations, and the conversation rises and slowly fades into silence, and you see behind every face the mental emptiness deepen, leaving only the growing terror of nothing to think about. Or when, under ether, the mind is conscious but conscious of nothing, I said to my soul, be still, and wait without hope, for hope would be hope for the wrong thing. Wait without love, for love would be love of the wrong thing. There is yet faith, but the faith and the love and the hope are all in the waiting. Wait without thought, for you are not ready for thought. So the darkness shall be the light, and the stillness the dancing. Whisper of running streams and winter lightning, the wild thyme unseen and the wild strawberry, the laughter in the garden, echoed ecstasy not lost but requiring, pointing to the agony of death and birth. You say I am repeating something I have said before. I shall say it again. Shall I say it again? In order to arrive there, to arrive where you are, to get from where you are not, you must go by a way where there is no ecstasy. In order to arrive at what you do not know, you must go by a way which is the way of ignorance. In order to possess what you do not possess, you must go by the way of dispossession. In order to arrive at what you are not, you must go through the way in which you are not. And what you do not know is the only thing you know. And what you own is what you do not own. And where you are is where you are not. That questions the distempered part. Beneath the bleeding hands, we feel the sharp compassion of the healer's art, resolving the enigma of the fever chart. Our only health is the disease, if we obey the dying nurse, whose constant care is not to please, but to remind of our and Adam's curse, and that, to be restored, our sickness must grow worse. The whole earth is our hospital endowed by the ruined millionaire, wherein, if we do well, we shall die of the absolute paternal care that will not leave us but prevents us everywhere. The chill ascends from feet to knees, the fever sings in mental wires. If to be warm, then I must freeze and quake in frigid purgatorial fires, of which the flame is roses and the smoke is briars. The dripping blood are only drink, the bloody flesh are only food, in spite of which we like to think that we are sound, substantial flesh and blood. Again, in spite of that, we call this Friday good. So here I am in the middle way, having had 20 years largely wasted, the years of l'entre-deux-guerres, trying to learn to use words, and every attempt is a wholly new start and a different kind of failure, because one has only learnt to get the better of words for the thing one no longer has to say, or the way in which one is no longer disposed to say it. And so each venture is a new beginning, a raid on the inarticulate, with shabby equipment always deteriorating in a general mess of imprecision of feeling, undisciplined squads of emotion. And what there is to conquer by strength and submission has already been discovered once or twice or several times by men whom one cannot hope to emulate, but there is no competition. There is only the fight to recover what has been lost and found and lost again and again. And now, under conditions that seem unpropitious, but perhaps neither gain nor loss, for us there is only the trying. The rest is not our business. Home is where one starts from. As we grow older, the world becomes stranger. The pattern more complicated of dead and living, not the intense moment isolated with no before and after, but a lifetime burning in every moment, and not the lifetime of one man only, but of old stones that cannot be deciphered. There is a time for the evening under starlight, a time for the evening under lamplight, the evening with the photograph album. Love is most nearly itself when here and now cease to matter. Old men ought to be explorers. Here and there does not matter. We must be still and still moving into another intensity for a further union, a deeper communion through the dark cold and the empty desolation, the wave cry, the wind cry, the vast waters of the petrel and the porpoise. In my end is my beginning.
This is Catherine Hastings. You're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. That was T.S. Eliot reading his poem, East Coker. We're going to go on to Dylan Thomas reading his short story, A Child's Christmas in Wales, in just one moment. But first, a little musical interlude. This is Katie Lang singing Hallelujah, written by Leonard Cohen, the great Leonard Cohen. This was recorded on her Hymns of the 49th Parallel album. ¶¶
heard there was a secret chord that David played and it pleased the Lord. You don't really care for music, do you? Well, it goes like this, the fourth, the fifth, the minor fall, the major lift, the baffled king composing hallelujah. Hallelujah. Hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah. Well, your faith was strong, but you needed proof. You saw her bathing on the roof, her beauty in the moonlight. Oh, tied you to her kitchen chair. She broke your throne and cut your hair. And from your lips she drew hallelujah. 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 Room and I've walked the floor. Used to live alone before I knew you. But I've seen your flag on the marble arch. Our love is not a victory march. It's a cold and it's a broken hallelujah. 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 Maybe there's a God above, but all I've ever how to shoot somebody who outdrew you. It's not a cry that you hear at night. It's not someone who's seen the light. It's a cold and broken hallelujah. 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 Hallelujah.
That was Katie Lang, and now it's time for Dylan Thomas. Here he is, reading A Child's Christmas in Wales.
One Christmas was so much like the other in those years around the Seatown corner now, out of all sound except the distant speaking of the voices I sometimes hear a moment before sleep, that I can never remember whether it snowed for 6 days and 6 nights when I was 12, or whether it snowed for 12 days and 12 nights when I was 6. All the Christmases roll down towards the two-tongued sea, like a cold and headlong moon bundling down the sky that was our street. And they stopped at the rim of the ice-edged, fish-freezing waves, and I plunge my hands in the snow and bring out whatever I can find. In goes my hand into that wool-white, bell-tongued ball of holidays resting at the rim of the carol-singing sea, and out come Mrs. Prothero and the firemen. It was on the afternoon of the day of Christmas Eve, and I was in Mrs. Prothero's garden waiting for cats with her son, Jim. It was snowing. It was always snowing at Christmas. December, in my memory, is white as Lapland, although there were no reindeers. But there were cats. Patient, cold, and callous, our hands wrapped in socks, we waited to snowball the cats. Sleek and long as jaguars and horrible whiskered, spitting and snarling, they would slide and sidle over the white back garden walls, and the lynx-eyed hunters, Jim and I, fur-capped and moccasined trappers from Hudson Bay off Mumbles Road, would hurl our deadly snowballs at the green of their eyes. The wise cat never appeared. We were so still, Eskimo-footed Arctic marksmen in the muffling silence of the eternal snows, eternal ever since Wednesday, that we never heard Mrs. Prothero's first cry from her igloo at the bottom of the garden. Or if we heard it at all, it was to us like the far-off challenge of our enemy and prey, the neighbor's polar cat. But soon the voice grew louder. "Fire!" cried Mrs. Prothero, and she beat the dinner gong. And we ran down the garden with the snowballs in our arms towards the house, and smoke indeed was pouring out of the dining room, and the gong was bombulating, and Mrs. Prothero was announcing ruin like a town crier in Pompeii. This was better than all the cats in Wales standing on the wall in a row. We bounded into the house laden with snowballs and stopped at the open door of the smoke-filled room. Something was burning, all right. Perhaps it was Mr. Prothero, who always slept there after midday dinner with a newspaper over his face. But he was standing in the middle of the room saying, "A fine Christmas," and smacking at the smoke with a slipper. "Call the fire brigade," cried Mrs. Prothero as she beat the gong. "They won't be here," said Mr. Prothero. "It's Christmas." There was no fire to be seen, only clouds of smoke, and Mr. Prothero standing in the middle of them waving his slipper as though he were conducting. "Do something," he said. And we threw all our snowballs into the smoke. I think we missed Mr. Prothero, and ran out of the house to the telephone box. "Let's call the police as well," Jim said, "and the ambulance. And Ernie Jenkins, he likes fires." But we only called the fire brigade, and soon the fire engine came, and three tall men in helmets brought a hose into the house, and Mr. Prothero got out just in time before they turned it on. Nobody could have had a noisier Christmas Eve. And when the fireman turned off the hose and was standing in the wet, smoky room, Jim's aunt, Miss Prothero, came downstairs and peered in at them. Jim and I waited very quietly to hear what she would say to them. She said the right thing, always. She looked at the three tall firemen in their shining helmets, standing among the smoke and cinders and dissolving snowballs, and she said, "Would you like anything to read?" Years and years ago, when I was a boy, when there were wolves in Wales and birds the color of red flannel petticoats whisked past the harp-shaped hills, when we sang and wallowed all night and day in caves that smelt like Sunday afternoons in damp front farmhouse parlors, and we chased with the jawbones of deacons the English and the bears, before the motor car, before the wheel, before the Duchess-faced horse, when we rode the daft and happy hills bareback, it snowed and it snowed. But here a small boy says, "It snowed last year, too. I made a snowman and my brother knocked it down, and I knocked my brother down, and then we had tea." But that was not the same snow, I say. Our snow was not only shaken from whitewash buckets down the sky. It came shawling out of the ground and swam and drifted out of the arms and hands and bodies of the trees. Snow grew overnight on the roofs of the houses like a pure and grandfather moss. minutely ivied the walls and settled on the postman opening the gate like a dumb, numb thunderstorm of white, torn Christmas cards. Were there postmen then, too? With sprinkling eyes and wind-cherried noses on spread, frozen feet, they crunched up to the doors and mittened on them manfully. But all that the children could hear was a ringing of bells. You mean that the postman went rat-a-tat-tat and the doors rang? I mean that the bells that the children could hear were inside them. I only hear thunder sometimes, never bells. There were church bells, too. Inside them? No, in the bat-black, snow-white belfries tugged by bishops and storks. And they rang their tidings over the bandaged town, over the frozen foam of the powder and ice cream hills, over the crackling sea. It seemed that all the churches boomed for joy under my window, and the weathercocks crew for Christmas on our fence. Get back to the postman. They were just ordinary postmen, fond of walking and dogs and Christmas and the snow. They knocked on the doors with blue knuckles. Ours has got a black knocker. And then they stood on the white welcome mat in the little drifted porches and huffed and puffed, making ghosts with their breath, and jogged from foot to foot like small boys wanting to go out. And then the presents, and then the presents after the Christmas box. And the cold postman with a rose on his button nose tingled down the tea tray slithered run of the chilly, glinting hill. He went in his ice-boned boots like a man on fishmonger's slabs. He wagged his bag like a frozen camel's hump, dizzily turned the corner on one foot, and by God, he was gone. Get back to the presents. There were the useful presents, engulfing mufflers of the old coach days and mittens made for giant sloths. Zebra scarves of a substance like silky gum that could be tug-of-war down to the galoshes. Blinding tam-o-shanters like patchwork tea cozies and bunny-suited busbies and balaclavas for victims of head-shrinking tripes. From aunts who always wore wool next to the skin, there were moustached and rasping vests that made you wonder why the aunts had any skin left at all. And once I had a little crocheted nose bag from an aunt now, alas, no longer whinnying with us. And pictureless books in which small boys, though warned with quotations not to, would skate on Farmer Giles's pond and did and drowned. And books that told me everything about the wasp, except why. Go on to the useless presents. Bags of moist and many-colored jelly babies, and a folded flag and a false nose and a tram conductor's cap and a machine that punched tickets and rang a bell. Never a catapult. Once, by a mistake that no one could explain, a little hatchet. And a celluloid duck that made, when you pressed it, a most unduck-like sound. A mewing moo that an ambitious cat might make who wished to be a cow. And a painting book in which I could make the grass, the trees, the sea, and the animals any color I pleased. And still the dazzling sky-blue sheep are grazing in the red field under the rainbow with billed and pea-green birds. Hard-boiled toffee, fudge and all sorts, crunches, cracknel, humbugs, glaciers, marzipan, and butter Welsh for the Welsh. And troops of bright tin soldiers who, if they could not fight, could always run. And snakes and families and happy ladders and easy hobby games for little engineers, complete with instructions. Oh, easy for Leonardo. And a whistle to make the dogs bark, to wake up the old man next door, to make him beat on the wall with his stick, to shake our picture off the wall. And a packet of cigarettes. You put one in your mouth and you stood at the corner of the street and you waited for hours in vain for an old lady to scold you for smoking a cigarette, and then with a smirk you ate it. And then it was breakfast under the balloons. Were there uncles like in our house? There are always uncles at Christmas, the same uncles. And on Christmas mornings, with dog-disturbing whistle and sugar fags, I would scour the swathed town for the news of the little world, and find always a dead bird by the post office or the white deserted swings. Perhaps a robin, all but one of his fires out. Men and women wading, scooping back from chapel with taproom noses and wind-busked cheeks, all albinos, huddled their stiff black jarring feathers against the irreligious snow. Mistletoe hung from the gas brackets in all the front parlors. There was sherry and walnuts and bottled beer and crackers by the dessert spoons. And cats in their furabouts watched the fires. And the high-heaped fires spat, all ready for the chestnuts and the mulling pokers. Some few large men sat in the front parlors without their collars, uncles almost certainly, trying their new cigars, holding them out judiciously at arm's length, returning them to their mouths, coughing, then holding them out again as though waiting for the explosion. And some few small aunts, not wanted in the kitchen, nor anywhere else for that matter, sat on the very edges of their chairs, poised and brittle, afraid to break like faded cups and saucers. Not many those mornings trod the piling streets. An old man, always fawn-bowlered, yellow-gloved, and at this time of year with spats of snow, would take his constitutional to the white bowling green and back as he would take it wet or fire or on Christmas Day or Doomsday. Sometimes two hale young men with big pipes blazing, no overcoats and wind-blown scarves, would trudge unspeaking down to the forlorn sea to work up an appetite to blow away the fumes, who knows, to walk into the waves until nothing of them was left but the two curling smoke clouds of their inextinguishable briars. Then I would be slap-dashing home, the gravy smell of the dinners of others, the bird smell, the brandy, the pudding and mince coiling up to my nostrils, when out of a snow-clogged side lane would come a boy, the spit of myself, with a pink-tipped cigarette and the violet past of a black eye, cocky as a bullfinch, leering all to himself. I hated him on sight and sound, and would be about to put my dog whistle to my lips and blow him off the face of Christmas, when suddenly he, with a violet wink, put his whistle to his lips and blew so stridently, so high, so exquisitely loud, that gobbling faces, their cheek bulged with goose, would press against their tinseled windows the whole length of the white echoing street. For dinner we had turkey and blazing pudding, and after dinner the uncles sat in front of the fire, loosened all buttons, put their large, moist hands over their watch chains, groaned a little, and slept. Mothers, aunts, and sisters scuttled to and fro bearing tureens. Aunt Bessie, who had already been frightened twice by a clockwork mouse, whimpered at the sideboard and had some elderberry wine. The dog was sick. Auntie Dursey had to have three aspirins, but Auntie Hannah, who liked port, stood in the middle of the snowbound backyard, singing like a big-bosomed thrush. I would blow up balloons to see how big they would blow up to, and then when they burst, which they all did, the uncles jumped and rumbled. In the rich and heavy afternoon, the uncles breathing like dolphins and the snow descending, I would sit among festoons and Chinese lanterns and nibble dates and try to make a model man-of-war following the instructions for little engineers and produce what might be mistaken for a sea-going dramgar. Or I would go out, my bright new boots squeaking into the white world onto the seaward hill to call on Jim and Dan and Jack and to pad through the still streets, leaving huge, deep footprints on the hidden pavements. I bet people will think they've been hippos. What did you do if you saw a hippo coming down our street? I'd go like this, bang! I'd throw him over the railings and roll him down the hill, and then I'd tickle him under the ear and he'd wag his tail. What would you do if you saw two hippos? Iron-flanked and bellowing he-hippos clanked and battered through the scudding snow towards us as we passed Mr. Daniel's house. Let's post Mr. Daniel a snowball through his letterbox. Let's write things in the snow. Let's write, Mr. Daniel looks like a spaniel all over his lawn. Or we walked on the white shore. Can the fishes see it snowing? The silent, one-clouded heavens drifted onto the sea, Now we were snowblind travelers lost on the North Hills, and vast dewlapped dogs with flasks around their necks ambled and shambled up to us, baying excelsior. We returned home through the poor streets, where only a few children fumbled with bare red fingers in the wheel-rutted snow, and cat-called after us, their voices fading away as we trudged uphill into the cries of the dock birds and the hooting of ships out in the whirling bay. And then at tea, the recovered uncles would be jolly, and the ice cake loomed in the center of the table like a marble grave. Auntie Hannah laced her tea with rum, because it was only once a year. Bring out the tall tales now that we told by the fire as the gaslight bubbled like a diver. Ghosts wooed like owls in the long nights when I dared not look over my shoulder. Animals lurked in the cubbyhole under the stairs where the gas meter ticked. And I remember that we went singing carols once when there wasn't the shaving of a moon to light the flying streets. At the end of a long road was a drive that led to a large house. And we stumbled up the darkness of the drive that night, each one of us afraid, each one holding a stone in his hand, in case, and all of us too brave to say a word. The wind through the trees made noises as of old and unpleasant and maybe web-footed men wheezing in caves. We reached the black bulk of the house. What shall we give them? Hark the herald? No, Jack said. Good King Wenceslas, I'll count three. One, two, three. And we began to sing, our voices high and seemingly distant in the snow-felted darkness round the house that was occupied by nobody we knew. We stood close together near the dark door. Good King Wenceslas last looked out on the Feast of Stephen. And then a small, dry voice, like the voice of someone who has not spoken for a long time, joined our singing. A small, dry eggshell voice from the other side of the door. A small, dry voice through the keyhole. And when we stopped running, we were outside our house. The front room was lovely. Balloons floated under the hot water bottle, gulping gas. Everything was good again and shone over the town. Perhaps it was a ghost, Jim said. Perhaps it was trolls, Dan said, who was always reading. Let's go in and see if there's any jelly left, Jack said. And we did that. Always on Christmas night there was music. An uncle played the fiddle, a cousin sang Cherry Ripe, and another uncle sang Drake's Drum. It was very warm in the little house. Auntie Hannah, who had got onto the parsnip wine, sang a song about bleeding hearts and death, and then another in which she said her heart was like a bird's nest. And then everybody laughed again, and then I went to bed. Looking through my bedroom window, out into the moonlight and the unending smoke-colored snow, I could see the lights in the windows of all the other houses on our hill, and hear the music rising from them up the long, steadily falling night. I turned the gas down. I got into bed. I said some words to the close and holy darkness, and then I slept.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you've been listening to Dylan Thomas reading A Child's Christmas in Wales. I hope you enjoyed tonight's program. If you have any questions, please contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. And for live events, check out www.wordtemple.com. Thanks for listening.